Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Stephen L. Kent, Rogue Clown. Narrated by Ken Jackson, with performances by Joe Brack, Terrence Azelford, James Lewis, Christopher Sheeran, Evan Casey, Elliot Dash, David Coyne, James Konacek, Tony Nam, Richard Rowan, Bradley Smith, Danny Gavigan, Mort Shelby, Thomas Keegan, Nanette Savard, Johan Detweiler, Dexter Hamlet, Dylan Lynch. Book 3, The Clone Alliance. I held the grenade in my left hand and fingered the pin with my right. I stood in the shadow-filled belly of a military transport. They called this the Kettle. You could cram 100 Marines into a transport like this, but I was alone. Almost alone. Ray Freeman, my partner, lay unconscious on the bench that ran along the wall. If he had been conscious, Ray would have wanted me to pull the pin. He would probably have shot me and pulled the pin himself if he saw me hesitating. That was our agreement.
No going back. No slow death.
If I pulled the pin, I would die in an instant. I wanted that. If I turned the transport around, I would starve on the long flight back to Little Man. If Ray woke up, he would shoot me. I wouldn't mind dying, but I didn't want him to think that I lost my nerve when it came time to pull the pin. I didn't even need the grenade. If I opened the hatch, we would get sucked out to space. Without protective suits, our bodies would burst. Just press the button. But I couldn't make myself do it. Could not pull the pin, could not press the button. Programming. Sliding doors don't swing. Mathematical engines don't spell words.
Liberator clones do not kill themselves.
So I would try to fly this bird back to Little Man and take the slow death instead. I had 1 week's worth of food, 6 weeks' worth of travel, and a ship that had been taken well beyond its limits more than a month ago. On the bright side, maybe Ray would wake up and shoot me. Earth date. September 12th, AD 2512. Galactic position, Scutum Crux Arm. When we left the colony on Little Man, one of the Neo-Baptists gave me a gift. By its shape and size, I could tell it was a book. Since all of the books on the little farming planet were of the religious sort, I did not bother unwrapping the package. Ray Freeman, my partner, and I had come to this planet after the fall of the Unified Authority, the Earth-based empire that populated and controlled the galaxy. We spent months trapped on Little Man. Then Freeman got an idea that would either get us back into society or kill us. Either option sounded better than life on Little Man. He wanted to adapt a short-range military transport for pan-galactic travel. The colonists gave us a glib, "Thanks for coming," and handed me a gift wrapped in a swatch of pearl-white cotton cloth. They said goodbye and walked off without a backward glance. That was also how Freeman and I left their planet, without a backward glance.
Think there's any chance this can work?
Does it matter?
The military shuttle became the instrument of our passive suicide, a short-range ship made to fly distances of 20,000 or 30,000 miles at a maximum speed of 200,000 miles per hour. We were going to crank up the speed, preferably to a respectable 10 million miles per hour, as we flew it to a satellite approximately 4 billion miles from this planet. In the unlikely event that we made it to that satellite, we would start the next phase in our suicide. We would attempt to adapt specialized equipment used for transferring ships across the galaxy to work on our transport. Freeman ignited the engines, and we took off in an arc. Haze gave way to blue, and soon blackness, as we left the atmosphere. Then Little Man was gone. The first thing we needed to do was pick up speed. It took us less than a minute to fly from the surface of Little Man to outside the atmosphere, and I already felt lonely sitting beside Freeman. I had had no interest in opening the gift that the Neo-Baptists gave me when I first boarded the transport. but traveling with Ray Freeman left me lonelier than traveling alone. After spending a few minutes watching him silently work the controls, I left the cockpit and climbed into the all-steel kettle. It was a dimly lit cavern with steel walls, a steel ceiling, and a steel floor. There I sat down on the wooden bench that ran along the wall and unwrapped the book. The cotton cloth square slid back, revealing an all-black cover made of leather. I was looking at the unmarked back cover of the book, but I recognized the Bible even before I turned it over and saw the gold letters.
Harris.
I keyed the intercom station in the wall.
Everything okay?
I'm gonna have a look at the engine and play with the fuel. Think you can keep an eye on the controls?
I've never flown one of these birds.
You won't be flying. I just need you to tell me the speed.
On my way.
I climbed the ladder and stepped into the cockpit. Freeman left without saying a word. I sat in the pilot's seat and watched the little red lighted display. Ray had us cruising along at 200,000 miles per hour. I don't know what Ray did to the engines, but the transport shook and convulsed, then slowed down. We had dropped to below 100,000 when he did something new and the speed started to build.
How fast are we going?
What did you do? We're at 500,000 and climbing.
We'd still starve to death at this speed, but we'd die closer to the broadcast station. I kept watching the speed increase.
We're up to 2 million.
Unfortunately, the speed topped out at 4 million miles per hour. That meant 1,000 hours, a six-week trip with 4 weeks worth of food. Once he got the transport flying at a few million miles per hour, Freeman spent most of his time toying with the electrical system and trying to figure out how he could splice parts from a broadcast station into the systems on the transport. We seldom spoke to each other. To keep from losing my mind, I started reading the Bible that the Neo-Baptist had given me. I originally decided that I would not read the book. I got desperate and read it several times. The Baptist would have been proud. When Freeman worked in the cargo bay, I took that Bible up to the cockpit and read. When Freeman lingered in the cockpit, I read in the gloom of the kettle. I kept out of his way unless he called me. Before starting my fifth trip through the Old Testament, I called up to the cockpit and asked Freeman how much farther to the broadcast station.
I don't know.
There was no use pushing him, so I opened to Genesis, and the hours rolled on. I really did not care about survival. After months of hearing people praise the Lord and plow the corn, I decided that I would rather die in space than live on Little Man. I did, however, want to reach my own personal promised land. Even if I did not get to return to Earth, I wanted to see that broadcast station. Amazingly, I got my wish. The broadcast station was the last vestige of a recently defunct transportation system that once served as a superhighway across the Milky Way. Even flying at the speed of light, and no unified authority ships could attain that speed, it would take you 100,000 years to cross the Milky Way. Most of the 180 planets populated by humans were 500 to 1,000 light years apart. The key to getting from one planet to another was broadcasting, a technology that translated spaceships and communications into data that could be transferred instantaneously from one location to another. Some ships, mostly scientific vessels, had onboard broadcast engines that enabled their pilots to plug coordinates into a computer and broadcast to any location. The vast majority of space travel, however, was routed through the broadcast network, a system of satellites called broadcast stations. Broadcast stations had separate disks for sending and receiving ships. Freeman proposed a plan to try and convert a standard short-range military transport into a self-broadcaster by installing a broadcast engine. He wanted to commandeer the broadcast engine from the sending disk of the nearest broadcast satellite and attach it to the electrical system in our transport. Assuming we could adapt the industrial-sized broadcast engine from the station to work on our ship, we could send ourselves to Earth or Mars or some other place in the heart of the Republic. The broadcast network was set up in a linear fashion. Each sending disk only sent ships to the next broadcast station down the line. The various stations did not need or have computers because their sending disks formed a dedicated conduit sending ships to a few select locations. No computers were necessary. All of the calculations were preset. That did not bode well for Freeman and me, as it meant we would have no way of aiming ourselves once we got the broadcast engine up and working, if we got the engine up and working. We might simply send ourselves into oblivion and never materialize again. Dropping our speed to a mere crawl, Freeman approached the broadcast station. From the front or the back, the satellite looked immense. Both the sending disk and the receiving disk were a full mile in diameter. They were made of mirrored glass.
Damn, Freeman. You actually got us here.
We went to go change into our space gear so that we could begin removing the engine from the station and ran into a problem. Ray, the one of us with the mechanical expertise, did not fit into the atmospheric suits that came with the transport. The suits were made for general-issue military clones, men who stood just under 6 feet tall. Ray stood over 7 feet tall and weighed approximately 350 pounds. The suit did not fit me so well either, but I managed. I stood 6'3", about 4 inches too tall. I forced my long arms into the sleeves and scrunched my back, then fastened the helmet over my head. Once I was dressed, Ray returned to the cockpit and vented the oxygen out of the kettle. With the air gone and the gravity off, he opened the 6-inch-thick metal doors at the rear of the kettle. Throughout my walk to the broadcast station, Freeman and I would have uninterrupted communications through the Interlink, a proprietary small-area communication system developed for military use. I had a video recorder built into the visor of my helmet. From the atmosphere-enclosed comfort of the cockpit, Freeman could monitor the images captured by that recorder and guide my every move. I hooked my tether line to a socket near the rear door of the transport and kicked off into space. Ahead of me, the dormant sending disc had the slight concave curvature of a dinner plate. Its reflective glass surface seemed to stretch on forever. I drifted toward it until I was close enough to tap my finger against its surface. I used the jetpack on my suit to propel myself along its face. When I reached the top, I looked back down to where I had come from. The disc was 3 inches thick and a full mile in diameter. From a distance, it looked sharper than a razor blade.
You ever done this before?
Have I ever done what? Free-walked in space or salvaged parts from a broadcast disc?
Free-walked.
Yeah.
You ever been behind the scenes at a broadcast station?
No.
Looking down the back of the glass, I saw the spindle that connected the sending and receiving discs, like an axle between two wheels. All of the generator and broadcast equipment would be housed in that spindle. From up here, a half a mile away, the hall connecting the two discs looked as narrow as a sewing needle.
Well, that's where you need to go.
I know that.
Even though they were dormant, the size of the discs made me nervous. I floated down the gap between them slowly. As I descended, I saw that the discs were 100 feet apart. From a distance, they seemed to butt right up against each other. Dropping between them, I felt like a diver entering a massive crevice. I dropped a good 1,000 feet and stopped. When I glanced in the direction that I had come from, it seemed like the gap between the two discs had narrowed. As I glided toward the spindle connecting the two discs, I wondered if the tether line would reach. Just for it to reach from the top of the discs to the spindle, it would need to be a half mile long. It wasn't. I was about halfway down the side of the disc when a message flashed on the visor of my helmet.
Caution, tether limit reached.
With trepidation, I detached my tether line and watched it reel away. Had there been a loop or a stem on the back of the disc, I would have tied it on. The back of the disc was as smooth as the front.
You there?
Yes.
The backs of the discs were black, but not reflective. Looking into the backs of the discs reminded me of staring into a shadow. I continued on to the spindle. I had not appreciated the size of the tube that connected the two sides of this broadcast station when I viewed it from the edge of the sending disc a half a mile away. From up there, it looked short and narrow. Now that I had floated down beside it, I realized it was the size of my boot camp barracks, 2 stories tall and 100 feet long. It only took me a moment to figure out how to enter the broadcast station. The batteries inside this station might not have had the terravolts needed to keep the discs operating, but they did have enough electricity to power the lights marking the door. I approached. The door was sealed, of course.
Respect. Think I should blast my way in?
See that red circle?
Beside the door was a 6-inch red circle.
That's a security panel. Press down on it.
I traveled over to the circle and pressed 3 fingers against it. The circle rolled over, and a laser no broader than a spaghetti noodle shot into my helmet to perform a retinal scan. I started to pull away.
What's the problem?
It won't recognize me. It will arm the security system.
Most of the techs who fix these stations are clones.
They're a newer model.
You think they updated the eyes?
I pressed the panel a second time and waited as the laser scanned my left eye. The door to the station opened.
That was easy.
Once inside the station, I found the master control panel. I found the switches for sealing the door and starting the gravity generator. I did not bother turning on the oxygen. Though the station did have an environmental system, I preferred my suit. I turned on the lights. The inside of the station looked like a warehouse. Equipment of every shape and size lined the walls. There were lockers and storage compartments. There were oxygen tanks, laser torches, jetpacks, racks of environmental suits, boxes of tools, and a credit-operated vending machine filled with snacks for the maintenance workers who would repair this station when and if it broke down. We had just about run out of food on the transport. Seeing that machine with its candy bars and potato chips nearly brought tears to my eyes. The moment I found the broadcast engine, my luck turned sour. The engine was 15 feet tall. It was built into the wall of the station. Because of its size and mass, there would be no way to disassemble it and carry it out piece by piece as we had planned.
Respect, it's too big. What do we do now?
Cut through the wall.
What about the station?
What about the station?
Won't that destroy the broadcast station?
You see anyone who's going to complain?
I went back to the entrance, selected a laser torch, and returned. With Freeman looking over my shoulder, I cut every cable and wire that connected the engine to the broadcast station. Before climbing under the cylinders to cut the outer shell of the satellite, I returned to the controls and turned off the gravity. Back on Earth, those brass cylinders of the broadcast engine would weigh several tons each. With the gravity off, their weight meant nothing, but their mass still posed a problem. Moving them from the station to the transport would not be easy. With Freeman directing me, I cut through the outer wall of the station. Once the incision was done, I braced myself against a rail and kicked one of the cylinders. The entire engine, outer wall and all, dropped out of the station as a unit. I would have needed a crane to move the broadcast engine back on Earth. Out here in space, I conveyed it using a cargo rig, a couple of synchronized jetpacks that I attached to the outermost cylinders using canvas cords. I stood on top of the broadcast engine, holding the reins in my hands, and rode it like a Roman riding a war chariot. I rode the engine between the discs and out to the transport. The broadcast engine was still attached to the portion of the wall that I cut out of the station. Before I could fit the engine into the transport, I would need to cut the engine free. With the small section of outer wall attached, the engine would not fit up the ramp of the kettle.
It's too wide to fit through the hatch.
I used the cargo rig's reverse thrusters to put on the brakes.
Cut the outer wall away.
With Freeman inspecting my every move to make sure I did not damage the cylinders, I used the laser torch to cut the brackets that attached the broadcast engine to the outer wall. Surprisingly, I did not damage the cylinders, nor did I cut any hidden cables. Once I got the cylinders into the transport, I stacked them on their sides like lumber. Freeman sealed the rear hatch as I brought in the last of them. As those cylinders weighed several tons each, Freeman left the gravity off while I tried to use the internal cargo arm to stand them and arrange them. That was when we ran into a problem. Transports like this were meant for hauling soldiers, not cargo. The average soldier stood just under 6 feet tall. The cylinders were 15 feet tall. The kettle, which had plenty of headroom for transporting Marines, had a 12-foot clearance.
I gotta come take a look.
Ray flooded the kettle with air and came out to inspect the problem. I removed my helmet.
It's too tall.
Can we leave them on their sides?
No. The bottoms are insulated. Everything else is made to conduct electricity. If we left them lying there, the brass would conduct the wrong charge into the hull of the ship.
Freeman solved the problem. There were storage compartments under the floor of the kettle. Using my laser torch, Freeman cut away a 30-foot section of floor, giving us access to the storage compartments below. The compartments were 4 feet deep, creating 1 foot of clearance between the tops of the cylinders and the roof of the ship. With the problem solved, Freeman went back to the cockpit and purged the oxygen out of the kettle. Then I used the cargo arm to drag those massive cylinders out of the kettle horizontally, bring them in diagonally, and drop them into place vertically. Once they were in place, Freeman sent me back to the broadcast station. This time he needed insulation blankets to prevent the electricity running through the cylinders from juicing the entire ship. When I returned, I had yards of rubberized blanket. I also brought every morsel from the vending machine. Freeman sealed the doors, pumped some O2 back in the kettle, and came to join me. I showed him the blanket.
We're gonna wrap this around the engine.
Yes.
Won't that affect the way they conduct electricity?
Yes.
So is this going to work?
Ray glared at me.
You hungry?
What do you have?
I showed Freeman the stash I had stolen from the vending machine. He chose some meat sticks. I ate a candy bar. Freeman had no trouble reassembling the various components of the broadcast engine. The design was modular. Once the cylinders were in place, he ran cables between them, then he spliced the cables into the generator that powered the shields for our transport. The operation took hours. He worked nonstop, never speaking a word. By the time Freeman finished, there were so many cables snaking in and out around the cylinders that we could no longer walk across the kettle without tripping.
Think the generator has enough juice for that monster?
There's plenty of power.
Should we boot it up?
You know this isn't going to work.
Freeman turned to stare down at me, those emotionless dark eyes of his showing me neither anger nor mercy. The top of the broadcast cylinders came closer to the roof than we expected. Thanks to the storage compartments, we had hoped for a 12-inch clearance. Once Freeman added all the wires and cables, the clearance came closer to 3 inches. Freeman held out his right hand and opened it for me to see what lay on his palm. The white grenade gleamed in Ray Freeman's shovel-sized hand, about the size of a golf ball. But in his giant paw, it looked smaller than a ping-pong ball.
What's that?
A grenade.
I know what it is. What's it for?
If the engine doesn't work.
I rolled the grenade in my hand.
Well, good luck.
I turned and headed to the cockpit. I would be safe there. Correction. I would not be safe, but I would be safer. If things went wrong, there might be enough left of me to pull the pin. The cockpit had a video screen on which I could watch Ray connect a few last cables. Giving his handiwork one final inspection, he dropped to his hands and knees and checked the insulation blankets along the base of the broadcast engine. Without so much as a moment's hesitation, he pressed the power button, routing the electricity from the shield generator into the broadcast engine. The disaster started quietly. I could hear as well as see everything on the screen. The shield generator ran smoothly. The cylinders caught the electrical charge from the generator and amplified it. Diodes at the top of the broadcast engine glowed black, then blue, then green, then yellow, then red as the charge intensified. This did not happen quickly. More than an hour had already passed. Then, an inch-wide arc of bluish-white electricity formed along the tops of the cylinders. At that exact moment, my monitor winked off, and the electrical system inside the transport shut itself down. The red emergency lights came on. The cockpit lights winked back to life, but the monitor showing the kettle stayed dark. I jumped out of my chair and started for the kettle.
Freeman, what happened? What happened?
A benevolent, though considerably smaller arc, danced along the points of the broadcast engine cylinders. At first, I thought there was still current running into the engine. Then I saw the charred and melted stump where the shield generator had been. The last fumes of the charge had caused the explosion. Freeman lay on the ground beside the shield generator. His face was burned. Shards of metal and plastic poked out of his skin. Rivulets of blood ran down the sweaty leather of his skin. His massive chest continued to heave with the even rhythm of his breathing. He looked bad, but he had survived. Glad to see that my friend was still alive, I pulled out that grenade and wrapped my finger around the pin. Ray Freeman was big and strong. A few pieces of shrapnel would not kill him. The grenade I held in my right hand could do it, though. He would want that. But before I pulled the pin, I decided to make Ray comfortable. Placing the grenade in a safe spot, I lifted Ray onto a bench and examined his wounds. The tang of his burned flesh filled my nose. The biggest and most dangerous man I had ever met lay totally vulnerable beside me. I rested him on his back and placed his hands on his stomach. I cleaned his wounds.
We gave it our best.
Then I picked up the grenade. I looped my finger into the pin and started to pull, but I could not do it. Trying to focus my mind on pulling the pin was like grabbing a wet bar of soap. The thoughts just slipped through my grasp.
Pull the pin. Pull the pin.
But every time I tightened my finger around the pin, I suddenly had an irresistible need to check on Freeman. It was like my brain purged the thought, and whatever thought filled the void became urgent. I would start to pull, feel a twitch, and momentarily forget what I was doing.
Programming.
As a Liberator clone, I was able to recognize my synthetic creation. As a Liberator, I knew that I was built to kill. It never occurred to me that I also had been programmed to live. I could not force myself to pull the pin from that grenade.
That is just specking great.
I threw the grenade on the deck, pin and all. I stormed over to the hatch controls. They were intact. All of the transport systems checked out in working order except the shields. Hesitating just for a moment, I reached for the button that would open the hatch. If I hit it, the rear of the kettle would split, and Freeman and I would be sucked into space. Death would come in an instant. But I could not get myself to press the button. It was right there, big and bright red, and shaped like a mushroom, but I could not press it.
Speck!
I could not open the hatch or pull the pin. I looked at the load of snacks I had brought back from the vending machine on the broadcast station. A few minutes ago, it had looked like a hoard. Now, in light of the hundreds of hours it would take to fly back to Little Man, the food seemed insignificant. I left Freeman unconscious in the kettle and entered the cockpit.
Unified Authority Transport, come in. Unified Authority Transport, come in.
I looked down at the radio in complete disbelief.
This is Transport. Who is this?
Transport. This is the SNN Sakura. Please hold for Governor Yamashiro.
I was 4 billion miles from a farming colony, an untold trillions of miles from civilized space, and whoever had found me wanted me to hold so that I could speak with an old friend. The cavalry had arrived in full force.
Colonel Harris, is that you?
Yamashiro, what the hell are you doing out here?
Ah, Harris, that is the question I wanted to ask you. We have been tracking you for some time, and your actions make no sense. Perhaps we can discuss your mission on my ship.
The war. Freeman and I freelanced for the Unified Authority, the pan-galactic evolution of the nation that had once been the United States of America. The Unified Authority explored the Milky Way, found that there was no intelligent life in the galaxy other than mankind, and colonized planets in all six of its arms. As the exploration continued, a fleet of scientific vessels vanished while mapping out a region of the galactic eye. Fearing that we had finally located bug-eyed monsters, the UA military went on high alert, while the Senate called for the creation of a self-broadcasting fleet of battleships. When the fleet launched, Senate Majority Leader Morgan Atkins, who had championed the project, accompanied it on its maiden voyage. The fleet broadcasted into the innermost curve of the Norma arm and disappeared. That was when the Liberators entered the picture. At the same time that Atkins called for his self-broadcasting armada, the Linear Committee, the executive branch of the Unified Authority government, created a super weapon of its own, a new line of military clones. Unlike later clones, which were raised in orphanages, that first batch of Liberators came out of the tube at the age of 20. They were fast, smart, and more independent thinking than any clones that had come before them. To help them confront an unknown enemy, Liberators were built with a combat reflex. When the shooting started, a gland inside the Liberators' skulls secreted a mixture of endorphins and adrenaline into their blood. It made them vicious, but it also kept them thinking clearly during the heat of battle. Using every self-broadcasting vessel available, the Navy sent these Liberator clones to the Galactic Eye, where they soon discovered that Atkins had founded a colony. He had commissioned the self-broadcasting fleet so that he could hijack it. Morgan Atkins, one of the most powerful men in the Unified Authority, had led the first large-scale rebellion against it. But he had not known about the Liberators. The clone invasion overran his settlement, forcing Atkins to escape into space with his fleet. The first Atkins evangelists appeared a few years after the battle in the Galactic Eye. They told stories about the good senator discovering a city in the center of a planet and making contact with a radiant being who threatened to eradicate mankind. According to Mogat dogma, Atkins signed a pact with his space angel in which he promised to deliver the Republic as a vassal nation in order to avert total eradication of mankind. Atkins' disciples preached independence from Earth. They called themselves the Morgan Atkins Believers. The government called them Mogats, an abbreviation of the name Morgan Atkins, and dismissed them as cranks. Over the next 50 years, however, the Atkins movement grew. By 2510, there were over 200 million of them, scattered across the 180 worlds of the Republic. They engaged in smuggling, sedition, and petty crimes. Whenever planets talked about breaking away from the Republic, Mogats were involved. But the Mogats could never have overthrown the Unified Authority on their own. In 2510, CATO, the Confederate Arms Treaty Organization, declared independence from the Unified Authority. The Confederate Arms included four of the six arms of the Milky Way. With tens of billions of citizens, the Confederate Arms provided the troops for a revolution, and the Mogats provided the fleet. The government labeled them separatists and set about squashing them until the attack. The Japanese got involved through the Confederate Arms. They had lived on a planet called Ezer Cree. When they petitioned to rename their planet Shin Nippon, the UA Senate branded it an act of sedition, and the Mogats helped them escape. In 2512, the separatists took the upper hand. By defeating the Earth fleet and destroying the broadcast network, they effectively shut down the Unified Authority by shutting down travel and communications between Earth and its colonies. That same day, the alliance between the Confederate Arms, the Japanese, and the Mogats collapsed. The Mogats seized control of most of the fleet. Yoshi Yamashiro had commandeered four battleships. I ended up on Little Man, not knowing how the Battle Royale had ended. For months, I wondered what became of Yamashiro and his four-ship fleet. Now, out of nowhere, he and one of his self-broadcasting battleships had appeared in my space. With some guidance from a flight deck officer, I flew my transport into one of the Sakura's launch bays. As the rear doors of the kettle opened, I saw Yamashiro and two of his officers waiting to greet me. Yamashiro was a short man whose black hair was turning white. He had powerful shoulders and a wide neck. His hands were covered with calluses. The calloused hands and his quiet confidence suggested some background in martial arts. Because he was a politician and not an officer, Yamashiro dressed in suits instead of a uniform. He seemed to own an endless supply of dark blue blazers and red neckties. The officers beside him wore the midnight blue uniform of the Shin Nippon Navy.
May I come aboard your ship?
Sure, you don't have to ask.
I would not dream of setting foot on your property without first asking permission. We spent several weeks looking for you. Do you know how we knew you were on Little Man?
Yamashiro spoke as he started up the ramp.
How did you know I was on that planet?
As my ship approached the planet, my radar man located the lifeless remains of a Unified Authority fighter carrier. One of them radioed me and said, "Someone has destroyed a fighter carrier out here." I told them, "We must have found him. Only Wason Harris could destroy such a ship."
He was talking about the Grant. I had seen the ship blow up, but I was not the one who did it. Yamashiro looked around the kettle with a bemused expression, smiling as he examined the broadcast engine sticking out of the cutaway floor.
My partner is hurt.
I see. Takahashi! Call for an emergency team! We have an excellent physician on board.
Moments later, an emergency medical team appeared.
Perhaps we should leave the team to attend to your friend. You and I have much to discuss.
As we left, Yamashiro's two-officer entourage fell in behind us, one standing a pace behind him to his left, and the other one a pace behind and to his right. Despite my presence, his men stayed in formation.
We have been tracking you for several weeks. You have proven a most interesting subject. At first, we thought you decided to leave the Marines and become a farmer. Then again, you must have changed your mind, or else you would not have left that planet.
Guess I wasn't cut out for the farming life.
We became confused when you flew away in a transport. There was no place to go in such a short-range vehicle.
We went up two levels on an elevator and came out in an area filled with civilian offices. This part of the ship was brightly lit. Rows of cubicles stretched from one wall to the other.
We soon realized you were flying to the broadcast station. There was some question about how you reached such a remote planet as Little Man in the first place. You must have traveled in a self-broadcasting ship.
That ship broke down.
And when you reached the broadcast station, you behaved in a most peculiar fashion. Some of my men thought you had discovered a way to restart the broadcast network, or at least a way to make the station operational. We watched you remove the broadcast engine.
He stopped speaking and waited for me to explain.
We were trying to splice the broadcast engine into the transport's electrical system.
And you tried to modify a transport so you could use it to broadcast? Harris, that would be suicide. You did not have a broadcast computer. Even if you managed to make the engine work, you could not control the broadcast. You would die.
Yes, I knew that.
My engineers tell me that you could not fly a transport through the broadcast network. The electrical current would atomize the metal in its hull.
I figured as much.
So you chose suicide over the life of a farmer?
That just about sums it up.
Perhaps I have not overestimated you after all, Harris.
Yamashiro turned back toward the officer behind us.
Takahashi did not believe that a clone such as yourself would have enough initiative to consider suicide. He bet me that you and your friend would not have flown out here if you did not believe you could restart the broadcast network.
Takahashi sneered at me as he handed Yamashiro a wad of bills.
I bet heavily that you would rather die than live as a farmer, Harris. Sadly, I will not get to enjoy my winnings. Takahashi is my son-in-law. My daughter will complain to her mother that I have robbed her husband of $200, and my wife will make me give the money back.
I glanced back at Takahashi, who positively beamed. Yamashiro started walking again. I followed. The officers behind us followed in stony silence.
How did they find us?
Freeman sat up in his hospital bed. The only time he would lie flat was when he was unconscious. At all other times, he sat up alert.
One of Yamashiro's officers must have seen the movie.
The movie?
The Battle for Little Man. Someone made a movie about the battle I fought on Little Man. It's a great movie. Unblemished propaganda without so much as a shred of accurate information.
In the movie, a natural-born version of me takes on 10,000 Mogats nearly single-handedly and saves 6 Marines. In real life, we were known as the Little Man 7, but there was nothing heroic about our survival.
Why were they looking for you?
Freeman's face had not healed. He had medical patches on his cheeks, forehead, over one eye, and on his neck. The burns left swollen areas that would become scars, but his skin had always been rough. These new scars blended into his face more naturally than the knot of scars on the back of his skull. With his dark brown skin, the back of his head resembled a mahogany burl.
I don't know. The only thing Yamashiro would tell me was that he wanted to hold a summit.
You trust him?
What does it matter? We're off the transport and back in the war.
When the war began, the Confederate arms, the Mogats, and the Japanese were allies, and no one quite knew who ran their navy. Yamashiro's Japanese officers, the men who renovated and commanded the ships, referred to the fleet as the Hinode Fleet. Around the unified authority, we usually called it the Separatist Fleet, because separatist was a catch-all phrase. Most of the senior officers called it the Mogat Fleet, however, because they blamed all of the trouble on the Mogats. Before the Mogats took control of the ships, or the Japanese renovated them, it was the Galactic Central Fleet, or GC Fleet for short. When the fleet launched, it included 200 cruisers, 200 destroyers, and 180 battleships. When it attacked Earth, it was down to 540 ships. The Mogats won that engagement, but the battle took a toll on their fleet. Over breakfast, Yoshi Yamashiro told me that the Hinode fleet had come out of the battle against the Earth fleet with 472 ships. To the best of his knowledge, the Confederate arms managed to hold on to 32 battleships and 25 destroyers when the alliance collapsed. That left the Mogats with 415 ships. He gave me an hour to discuss this intelligence with Freeman, then called for us to meet with him to discuss his plans.
The Mogats have declared war on the Confederate arms. They have not yet found Shin Nippon, but I believe they plan to attack us as well.
This was not a summit. If I had to label the conclave, I would have called it a sales meeting. We sat in a small conference room with tweed-lined walls and a 10-foot table. Bright light filled the room.
We do not think it likely that the Mogats will attack any of the existing UA fleets. The Mogat fleet is too weak, and the UA fleets are too immobile to pose a threat.
Sitting behind Yamashiro, Takahashi and some officer whom I could not identify did their best impressions of ancient samurais.
We estimate that the Akins believers still possess over 100 battleships. This gives them a tactical advantage over any planet in the galaxy. As we saw in the days before the attack on Earth, ground defenses are not effective against orbital attack. The Mogats have proven most unstable. So far, we know that they have attacked 7 planets in the Orion arm, 8 planets in the Cygnus arm, and 5 planets in the Perseus arm.
Yamashiro turned to Freeman.
I assume you are also familiar with Mogat tactics?
Freeman nodded.
Are you a Marine, like Harris?
I freelance.
Ah, so it is.
Has anyone tried to retaliate?
This is a war of ghosts. Unified Authority ships cannot retaliate unless they happen to be in orbit around a planet when the Mogat ships arrive. The Confederates cannot afford a fight. Their navy is far too small to engage the Mogat fleet.
Have the Mogats returned to Earth?
Their only interest in Earth was to cripple the Unified Authority. Once the broadcast network was destroyed and Earth was cut off, they turned their attention to other planets. From what we can tell, the Mogats attacked a few select Earth targets after defeating the Earth fleet. I don't think they attacked Washington, D.C.
Where did they attack?
They attacked approximately 600 strategic targets across North America.
They went after the orphanages.
Yes. It appears that the Unified Authority does not plan to rebuild the orphanages. We have surveyed the damage from space. No work has been done.
They may be afraid to. They lost their fleet in the war. They don't have any way to protect themselves if the Mogats return. And they may be afraid of provoking them.
I agree. I believe this is also the reason they have not tried to rebuild the Mars broadcast station. They are afraid of provoking another attack.
What do you have in mind?
Shin Nippon is prepared to form an alliance with the Unified Authority and the Confederate Arms. None of our armies can defeat the Morgats alone. When the Morgats discover Shin Nippon, their fleets will defeat us. They will roll over us like a wave crushing a sandcastle on a beach. The Confederate Navy is also too small to oppose the Morgats, and the land forces are useless against an orbital attack. Only the Unified Authority has enough ships to fight the Morgats, but their ships do not have self-broadcasting ability.
The UA Navy is useless. They're beached without the broadcast network.
Exactly. It is exactly so.
If you're talking about restoring the broadcast network, it can't work. We'd never be able to defend it. The Morgats would be able to shoot it down anytime they wanted.
I agree with you, Harris. We would not be able to defend the broadcast network even if we could repair it. For now, I simply propose an alliance. Nothing more.
How do we play into this?
I should have thought that was obvious. We need to send somebody to Earth to propose our alliance.
You want us as ambassadors?
You mean you're using us as guinea pigs? You want to see if we can land on Earth without getting shot?
Yes. You are perfect for the job. Kampai! It means dry grass.
Dry glass?
Yes, dry glass.
We had come to the officers' club to celebrate the sale. Yamashiro had sold Freeman and me the concept of going to Earth. Now it was time to mark the occasion with booze. We sat on mats beside a table that only came up to our knees. I had seen bars like this on Ezra Cree, the planet these men had once called home. This was their idea of a traditional pub. Sitting around the table, all of Yamashiro's officers became equals. Hideo Takahashi sat shoulder to shoulder with Yamashiro himself, and the two men spoke freely. It no longer mattered that Yamashiro was the chief administrator of Shin Nippon, or that he was Takahashi's father-in-law. Takahashi no longer played the samurai, and Yamashiro no longer played the shogun. A pretty waitress in a silk kimono came in and placed four ceramic bottles on our table. Then she handed out lacquered cups. She had long black hair, combed back into an elaborate bun.
You have women on your battleship. That's unusual.
One of the officers poured cups of sake and passed them along the table. We all took one.
Do you know sake?
I've heard of it. Some of the guys in my platoon tried it when we were on Ezra Cree.
But you did not try it?
No.
Kampai!
Everyone tossed the sake into their mouths, and as far as I could tell, swallowed without tasting. I drank the contents from my cup. It was warm. Freeman held his cup, but never drank. This ritual continued for a number of rounds, with each man consuming his own personal bottle of sake.
I don't worry about the women on my ship, especially this one.
Yamashiro watched the waitress enter the room. She brought four more bottles of sake.
I have had her a few times myself.
Why isn't your friend drinking?
Takahashi turned to Freeman.
Don't you like sake?
I don't drink.
How can that be?
I've had most of the girls in the administrative area.
Yamashiro was now on his fifth or sixth cup. I was still on my third, not that it would have mattered. Whether by accident or by design, Liberator clones had a nearly superhuman tolerance for alcohol.
Kampai!
Another round of sake disappeared from the table. That pretty waitress returned every 5 or 6 minutes with more bottles. Judging by Yamashiro's responses to her, each time she returned, she became more beautiful.
How can you not drink? Everybody must drink! You cannot live if you do not drink.
You know the secretary that brought the coffee to our meeting this morning? I had her too. In that very room. She was very loud.
Oh.
Across the table, Takahashi continued to interrogate Freeman.
Do you drink whiskey?
Freeman shook his head.
Just beer?
I don't drink beer.
There is a beautiful girl in the officer's mess who will let you eat sushi of her naked body. When you finish your meal, you can have her. She's a very pretty. I have never eaten sushi so quickly in my life. Kampai!
Yamashiro opened his mouth and downed another cup of sake. All of his officers followed. The officers became louder and more demonstrative as they drank. By the end of the night, Yamashiro was lighting his cigarettes with the butts of the cigarettes he had just finished. Many of the other officers smoked too. A cloud of silver-blue smoke hung just under the ceiling. I stared into that cloud and wondered about the Jekyll and Hyde nature of these officers. On duty, these men were quiet, precise, in control. After hours, they drank harder than any other men I knew. The last time I visited Earth, the Earth fleet ruled the skies and the Unified Authority ran the galaxy. Since that time, the Mogats and their allies shut down the broadcast network. I had no idea what to expect when Freeman and I landed in Washington, D.C. During the war, I visited a planet named New Columbia a few days after a Mogat attack. When I entered Safe Harbor, the capital city of New Columbia, I found many of the buildings intact, but the society was demolished. In the days leading up to the attack, the government had evacuated the law-abiding citizens of Safe Harbor. That left the looters, the criminals, and the military in the city when the Mogats began their attack. They orbited the planet, destroying military bases, gun emplacements, and convoys. By the time I arrived, anarchy had taken over in Safe Harbor. Rival gangs had already carved the city into territories. The only way to reintroduce civilization back into Safe Harbor would have been to fumigate the place and start from scratch.
You think it'll be like Safe Harbor?
I spoke to Freeman as we carried our equipment into the transport.
If it is, this will be a short trip.
In his rucksack, Freeman carried a sniper rifle, two M27s with one rifle stock, a particle beam pistol, one dozen grenades, and extra ammunition. The bag weighed 40 or 50 pounds, and he carried it as easily as a sack lunch. He had already strapped a combat knife to his leg. The knife had a 10-inch blade. He was a human fortress. I'd brought an M27 and three extra clips. Ray thought like a mercenary, a lone gunman who sometimes found himself waging war against an entire army. I thought like a Marine. I preferred to travel light. Because we had no idea what we would find on Earth or in the space that surrounded it, Yamashiro and his officers took special precautions. The broadcast generator on the SNN Sakura needed 8 minutes to generate enough electricity to power up its broadcast engine. That meant that from the time the Sakura arrived in Earth space to the time it could broadcast out, there would be 8 minutes in which enemy ships could attack. If we accidentally broadcast it into the middle of the Mogat fleet, or if the Unified Authority somehow resurrected its Earth fleet, the Sakura would need to scramble for safety. Unaccompanied battleships made easy targets when things went wrong. The door to the launch bay opened, and in walked Takahashi, Yoshi Yamashiro's son-in-law, along with a junior officer. He came to salute us and see us off the ship.
We will broadcast in on the dark side of Earth.
The dark side was a navigational term, referring to the side of Earth facing away from Mars. Historically, almost every ship heading into Earth had to come through the broadcast network which orbited Mars. Now that the Mars disks were down, all of Earth was technically dark.
How far out are we broadcasting?
30 million miles. We'll fly you within 3 million miles. You'll have an hour before you have to launch.
Not even the most sophisticated tracking equipment could pick up a ship from beyond 30 million miles. Tracking anomalies was a different story. An anomaly was the electrical field that ships generated when they broadcasted into space. Even the most basic equipment could detect an electronic disturbance such as an anomaly from a few million miles away. On the off chance that the Mogats did have a fleet somewhere in the vicinity, the Sakura would broadcast well out of range. Traveling at a top speed of just under 30 million miles per hour, it would take us an hour to reach Earth, but that also meant that the broadcast engine could recharge. The Sakura would be able to broadcast to safety the moment our transport left the ship.
Prepare for broadcast. Prepare for broadcast.
Tint shields formed over portholes and windows. All of the atmospheric locks in the launch bay sealed. The broadcast itself happened in a split instant. We disappeared from the outer region of the Scutum Crux arm in a flash of lightning and appeared 30 million miles from Earth in that same instant. A moment later, the atmospheric locks opened. I knew we were back in the Sol system of the Orion arm. Freeman and I headed into our transport.
Earth won't be like New Columbia.
Freeman was heading up the ladder toward the cockpit.
They evacuated Safe Harbor before the Mogats attacked. The only people left on the planet were the criminals.
They left the Army and Marines.
I followed him up the ladder.
Yeah.
This was not the transport in which Yamashiro had found us. The crew of the Sakura jettisoned that ill-fated ship. Yamashiro's engineers said that our broadcast engine experiment had damaged it beyond repair.
Earth is different. The government is still down there, not just a bunch of shell-shocked Marines.
Freeman sat in the pilot's chair and went over the controls. I sat in the co-pilot's seat and fastened the safety harness across my chest. My thoughts wandered back to New Columbia and the gang-riddled city of Safe Harbor.
Prepare to launch.
Takahashi's voice came over the radio. Yamashiro had not bothered to see us off himself.
Ready.
The heavy doors of the atmospheric locks slid open, revealing the curtain of space. The deck officer cut the gravity in the launch bay so that we lifted off the deck the moment Freeman touched the boosters. Freeman took us 5 feet up, then floated us through the doors and into space.
Once we enter the atmosphere, they're bound to spot us.
Earth loomed ahead, a glowing green and blue sphere with polar white caps, tan-colored deserts, and swirls of cloud. We came in toward the coast of Europe, adjusted our angle parallel to the ocean below us, and flew west. A blue sky with clouds the size of city blocks stretched out before us.
Now we're about 2,000 miles from Washington airspace.
Do you think they saw us coming?
Yes.
Do you think they will try to intercept us?
Depends on just how bad the city was hit.
Yamashiro said that the Mogats only took out the clone farms and the bases.
Maybe. I don't think he's spent much time around here. His officers seem nervous about running into the Mogat fleet.
We entered the atmosphere at Mach 2. Soon Ray cut our speed to 1,000 miles per hour. At that speed, it took us 2 hours to reach Washington, D.C. The Atlantic Ocean stretched out beneath us like a gray-blue carpet, but it did not seem long before we reached the end. Up ahead of us, I could see the coast. Green forests and rocky cliffs marked the edge of the sea. Clouds so effervescent they should have been steam melted into the horizon.
Here comes our escort.
Up ahead, three fighters scrambled out to meet us. They left billowing contrails across the sky.
We got three more behind us.
I looked at the radar screen. It showed three blips behind us and three more ahead.
How long have they been there?
Within radar range? A few seconds. They picked us up back at Iceland. They've been giving us room to maneuver.
But they haven't tried to contact us?
No.
Maybe they're scared.
Transport pilot, this is Dulles Civil Traffic Control. Please respond.
This seems awfully polite.
They think we're Mogats. We just came out of a GCF battleship.
I'll bet you're right. They're either scared or glad to see us.
We were getting close to Dulles Spaceport.
Dulles Civil? This is Transport Pilot.
What is your destination, Transport Pilot?
We wish to land at Dulles Spaceport.
You are cleared for runway 1.
That was easy.
I've never felt so welcomed.
By this time, we had crossed green belts and the bays. Flying at 1,000 miles per hour, we passed from sea to city in 4 minutes. Freeman slowed the transport to landing speed, and we followed our fighter jet escort to the runway. We touched down and taxied into a hangar.
Leave your gear in the transport.
A sergeant came with a squad of 20 soldiers. These men were regular army, dressed in standard army fatigues, on loan to the Dulles Spaceport Authority. They all carried M27s as a matter of course. None of them pointed their weapons at us. The sergeant listened to a receiver concealed in his helmet.
Do you have any cargo you wish to unload?
Nope.
Freeman pressed a button, and the rear of the transport shut behind us.
You don't have a messiah on that transport, do you?
A what?
A messiah?
Not so much as an angel.
Just checking. You didn't bring pamphlets or space Bibles, did you?
Sergeant, I have no idea what you were talking about.
Okay, just checking. Why don't you gentlemen come with us? There are people waiting to debrief you.
The soldiers had parked a covered wagon just outside the hangar. Covered wagon meant an army transport truck with a heat-shielded tarp. We rode in it to our next destination.
You guys aren't Morgan Atkins separatists?
Not likely.
The sergeant had identified me as a clone when he met us outside our ship. I had the same brown hair and brown eyes as other clones. My facial features looked somewhat similar to the features on all of these boys. If you stood us beside each other, people would have thought I was their taller and more scarred-up brother.
Our traffic guys tracked you coming in from a Mogat ship. Your transport looks like it's Galactic Central vintage.
It is. Not all of those ships are under Mogat control.
No shit. Does that mean the Separatists are fighting among themselves?
We rumbled up a ramp and into a covered tunnel. Looking out the back of the truck, I could see a concrete ceiling with rows of fluorescent fixtures.
The Confederates, the Mogats, and the Japanese. It's a three-way split.
Damn. Who's winning?
The Mogats.
Damn.
What did you mean about having a messiah on our ship?
Oh, that? That was a Mogat thing. They dressed a transport up so that it looked like a golden chariot, then they set it down in Israel. They had some guy dressed in a white robe come out the back and say he was Jesus returning to claim the world.
You're joking.
Nope.
How do you know it wasn't Jesus?
The guy died. He landed by some old temple in Jerusalem. I think he was hoping for Christian pilgrims, but he got Jews and Muslims instead. They stoned him to death before the police could arrive. Anyway, his chariot came out of a GCF ship just like yours.
The truck pulled to a stop in an underground parking area. One of the soldiers flipped the ladder out the back of the truck, and the others started filing out. After most of the soldiers climbed out of the truck, Freeman climbed out.
And the Space Bible?
The sergeant and I were the last people out of the truck. I knew what Space Bibles were. That was the name people commonly called Man's True Place in the Universe, The Doctrines of Morgan Atkins, the book that the Mogats called the centerpiece of their religion. It was illegal for servicemen to read it.
Proselytizing. That's their latest. They come by every few weeks and chuck pamphlets and Space Bibles out of their ships. I guess they're looking for converts.
The soldiers led us into an office complex that appeared devoid of people. There seemed to be nothing wrong with the building itself. The lights and the air conditioning worked fine. I could not tell whether it had been abandoned or evacuated, but this wing of the building was empty.
The Mogats want to start a church on Earth.
They're not getting many converts. Sometimes they fly over cities, see? And then they start shoveling out them pamphlets and Space Bibles. I figure they hit a few thousand people. Killed most of them, too.
Shit. You drop a 2-pound book from a few miles up, and you gotta figure you're gonna deal some damage.
The sergeant took Freeman and me to a small office. There were no lights in the office. The only light came from the hall. We waited for nearly an hour in that dark room. Then the sergeant received a message on his radio.
Time to deliver you both.